Welcome to the John, Paul, and Mike Show. My name is Paul Holmes.
My name is John Jurisic. It's been a while.
It's
been sunny. We've been sunning.
Suntanning. Been suntanning here in lovely Victoria, British Columbia. So we're back.
We're back. And there's been a ton of stuff happened since our last interview.
Yeah, what the heck happened? Oh, you had a grandchild come visit.
I've had a grandchild come visit. I've been suntanning a lot.
Yeah.
Because in beautiful BC, beautiful Victoria, that's what we do here.
Invite the world. Invite the world. Come and bring your tourism dollars to our lovely city.
I was very active in the Fern Fest activities over the weekend.
Oh, fun.
And Fern Bites, which my daughter Catherine Jurisic, a personal plug, was a co-organizer. So I've had a lot of fun since our last discussion.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, it's good to be back. And today we have a guest with us. Would you like to introduce the guest,
John? Yeah, we sure do. A Mr. Niall, Paul Thiel. And Niall is 21 years old. He is planning to run for a municipal council seat in Central Saanich this November. And I think that it's great to have you on the show and to talk to you about why the hell does somebody so young, you're 21, want to do this job? And I think that then talks more broadly around youth and politics and that whole issue of getting people involved and how maybe you can get them and influence them to be involved.
Well, first off, thank you very much, John and Paul, for having me. It's very exciting and it's great to be here. And yes, as a young person getting involved in politics, I do get that question from time to time. Why are you involved or why do you want to be involved? And I think it's an important one. I think it's an important one to have when we consider in a democratically elected council, having representation, making sure that there is a gamut of people, a mix of people who are sitting there around the table and able to collegially work with other councillors.
Well, in our last interview, we chatted with Lisa Helps. Mm-hmm. Lisa Helps is a mayoral candidate in Victoria, and she helped me identify that actually over half of the population is under the age of 40. Are you familiar in Central Saanich, which for some of our out-of-town listeners is one of 13 municipalities that form what we call Greater Lower Vancouver Island Region. Are you familiar with, to put you on the spot, the demographics in Central Saanich?
Demographically, I don't have the census data sitting right in front of me the last census. Yes, exactly. Yeah. First slip up there. So that's all right. I believe the median age, though, is between 55 and 57, if I remember correctly, from the last census data. So I think that it, compared to Victoria, it is probably a little bit of an older municipality, demographically speaking.
Are you familiar, however, with how many folks out there are younger as opposed to older?
Numbers, not at the moment, not off the top of my head.
Well, this is pretty exciting. I actually had the opportunity to make a snide post on Facebook. Could you imagine that?
You.
Yeah. And so a friend of mine, Susan Jones, who you know, she's been involved with municipal amalgamation.
Related issues,
among other things. And she posted on Facebook what every candidate needs to know, which is a brochure, you may have even seen it, that's sort of out there explaining to people how they can run and stuff. So I decided to chime in with my advice, which is what every candidate needs to know. 99% of the decisions you make will be reviled by 0.2% of the population, lauded by 0.1% of the population, and ignored by 99.7% of the population. The other 1% of what you do will be sewage treatment. So tell us, Niall, what do you think about sewage treatment?
Did you make that post yourself?
Yeah, that was me. Yeah. I know. Sometimes I can be sarcastic.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Now, sewage treatment in the CRD is an extremely contentious issue right now. And actually, when it comes to the Saanich Peninsula, we actually have a joint treatment strategy between North Saanich, Central Saanich, and Sydney. Our tertiary sewage is actually used to warm Panorama Rec Center. And so we actually, it's a non-issue for us. I was speaking to a counselor in Sydney who mentioned that, she would actually like to see more dialogue between Victoria and, the peninsula, because we've got it figured out. We did it, I think, over 10 years ago now. And, I wish you luck in Victoria with your sewage treatment issues.
So I don't know if you know this, but I ran for city council in Victoria a couple times. Did you know that, John?
Yeah, I did know that.
Yeah.
And I think you got pretty close, actually, if I recall.
Well, I wouldn't say pretty close, but of the
closest of the
independent candidates, because I ran as an independent candidate, mostly just because nobody would take me. But I ran as an independent candidate. There's lots of slates back then. But the first time I ran, I was 23 years old. Huh. And when I showed up on the doorstep, it was interesting to see how people responded. They, you know, oh, don't you think you're a little too young to run for, you know, for politics? And so I would just like to say to Niall, don't put up with any of that nonsense. That's total crap. You know, it's one thing to say, do we need a, you know, I don't want to see a council that's made up of eight or six. Is it six?
Six, yeah.
I don't want to see a council made up of six 70-year-olds. I don't want to see a council made up of six 40-year-olds. And I don't want to see a council made up of six 20-year-olds, right? There's a diversification of people in the community, and the council should be representative of that. Mm-hmm. If that means one or two people are in their 20s, I say the community's better for it. And, you know, honestly, I've yet to endorse a candidate for anything, but I've actually got a new policy. If a candidate, for municipal, council in this region who's under the age of 25 and isn't crazy, shows up, they have my endorsement.
Well, we've yet to determine if Niall is crazy or not.
Well, all right.
but so far he sounds a whole lot more sensible than you and I. Why don't you talk about or allude to this issue of youth in politics and just amongst your peers, what's the sense? Do they care? Are folks interested in issues?
It's a really interesting one. And I thank you for telling us your own story about running for politics. And, personally, I found actually I've been surprised about the amount of support that I've been given. Being a young person, I expected a lot of animosity in the neighborhoods and stuff about door knocking as a young person and being told I'm too young. Sure, the issue comes up, but at the same time, I think people are really excited to see somebody that brings a new energy and new perspective of the, you know, 21st century education to politics. And I think what I don't have with age, I have with energy and sincerity and a work ethic, right? And I'm not going to pretend to know everything. So I expect to learn along the way, but I think every counselor in their own right has to learn along the way as well. Now, when it comes to youth in politics in general, I think that what we see is there's a bit of a disconnect sometimes between people acknowledging even their benefit of their vote, right? The benefit of putting a vote forward in a support for a particular party or particular platform. I've gone to Bayside Middle School, the middle school in Central Saanich, and also Stelly Secondary School, and I've spoken at classes about the significance of voting and what that means. And I take it back to a bit of an economic argument where you can see a vote as a purchase of the product that every party is putting forward as their platform, or every candidate puts forward as their platform. And if you don't purchase that product, well, then from a business perspective, as you two both know, there's no reason to sell to them. Right. And so you see the products are going to be more disenfranchising for young people, because why would I purchase that with my vote? Right. Why am I buying into this product when there's no reason to, or there's no benefits for me? So you tend to see, I believe Vaughn Palmer in the Vancouver Sun wrote an article, and I think the title of it was, in BC politics, to the aged go the spoils. And I think that I don't want to make it an ageist thing, because I think policy can benefit all ages within the community. But when it comes to engagement for youth, I think that's where the disconnect comes from. And I think the best thing we can do is just vocalize and raise awareness about it.
So one of my big beefs, really in every municipality in this in this region is facilities for youth. And when I talk about youth, I mean generally people younger than yourself. You know, it strikes me that there's an awful lot of things that kids can be getting involved in that involves creating trouble. and you know, the grown-ups in their 40s and 50s and 60s really don't necessarily have any idea what would engage these kids to keep them, you know, out of trouble and doing perhaps productive things and contributing to their communities, as so many of them do independently. But you know, certainly that's not the norm. So I wonder if you have any thoughts specifically in Central Saanich, but certainly regionally as well, ways to engage youth, you know, in summertime when they could be hanging out at convenience stores. I don't know.
Eating lots of candy.
Doing whatever they do.
Yes, eating too much candy. That is actually the issue on the peninsula.
That is a huge issue right now.
So I remember seeing an article a bulletin by the police department in Central Saanich, and I think they referred to it as packs of youths.
Yeah.
And it makes them sound like Tijuana dogs, but I understand the issue, and I do think that it's one that is a regional issue. I think you hit it on the head there. And when it comes to those facilities, I mean, one of the things that we did when going around to the middle school and high schools was, I mean, taking pictures of kind of derelict buildings, maybe in Keating or other areas, and saying, like, what would you guys put here? Right? What would you like to see? One of the most interesting ones I got from Bayside was they said, wouldn't it be great if they made a, you know, if let's say a business like Sports Traders were to come in, and then because those lots in Keating are so long, right? You could use the back half of the lot as like a ball hockey court where they could actually try out the equipment and stuff like that. So it's pretty evident that people are looking for things to do, right? There, and it's really tough to play to that demographic and understand what sells to them, right? What is actually an interesting thing to do that will keep you engaged and away from doing other things that may not be as constructive. I was big into sports when I was in high school. I know that benefited me because it taught me, you know, the outcomes are important and that hard work does create results. But I think in general, one of the focuses that I would like to see Panorama Rec Center taking, because that is a joint facility between Central Saanich, North Saanich, and Sydney. I would like to see Panorama looking at more options for parents to leave or send their kids that are constructive between the ages, or sorry, between the times of 2 p.m. till 5 or 6 p.m., right? Because that's when mom and dad have to be going to the grocery store. They have to pick up another sibling from some other activity. I think it's personally from the conversations I've had, that's the time when families feel the pinch, right? That's when the stress comes from, yeah. Because you've got to be driving. It's the commuting time. If you're living somewhere else, commuting is an issue.
Yeah. Well, and I think you, as a parent, you've hit the nail on the head. You know, you understand the issue probably better than most politicians that I've met. You know, with the school strike, you know, it was bad. It's already difficult enough juggling after school. But, you know, when the schools are on strike and there's no care, all of a sudden it becomes, a lot more difficult.
So, Niall, often the so-called youth vote, the youth demographic, is today associated with what we might call a environmental vote, a green vote. I think that's unfair. I do think your generation is very much aligned to those issues, and I don't think that's entirely the case. I think that's very important, but I do think there are other issues as important that aren't being talked about in and amongst your generation, i.e. jobs, i.e. getting a job, the cost of education. There's a lot of other things for your generation, I think, that are important. Want to talk about that in this sort of, I think, unfair bias that everyone under 30 is a hardcore environmentalist, and everything that comes out of their policy mind, you know, is dealing with those issues.
No, it is I think that is a conception that people have. I don't know if it's unfair. I think one of the advantages to, once again, having a young person elected or somebody, you know, who's been through the school system recently and been to university recently is the fact that it's not that I'm a, you know, bleeding heart green, if you will, But what it means is that because I've been raised with the idea of climate change, right? With those ideas being cycled through the school system at all times, it means when I go to make a decision, that is always a lens that I use. It's always a frame of mind that I use. So we can talk about jobs and we can talk about economic development. And I love to do that. I'm happy to do that. Yeah, it's,
and we have.
And it, yeah. Yeah. And we have. And it's the policy that I'm genuinely interested in. But it also means that I do come with that consciousness, with a level of that consciousness to the table. And I do think it's an advantage because for some, it might be something that they're either just learning about or just learning to frame their minds or wrap their minds around. For me, it's something that we wake up every day and consider.
So then what are some of the other issues of importance to your generation, to young people that, could be as equally important as the environmental or the climate lens issues?
Well, I think you said it. Jobs and affordable housing right now are extremely important. It's one of those things that I think when you get that census data back or you get that information from the Victoria Foundation where they do their vital signs throughout the municipality in the greater Victoria area, you learn consistently that from people of all ages, it's a concern. Where am I going to live and how am I going to put food on the table, right? And I think that that's an issue that gets a little bit It gets skirted a little bit because I think it's fun and it's easy to talk about those environmental issues. But at the end of the day, I mean, those are those kind of fundamental, physiological concerns that people have for themselves. And, in the greater Victoria area, I think that the issue is really the location, right? As you said, we have 13 municipalities and I think people will, you'll hear stories about people where they'll be able to count on their hand and they'll be able to say, I drove through four municipalities on my way to work today. And in getting there, I mean, it's a huge commute. And I know actually, in Central Saanich, we have one of the highest carbon emissions as our CO2 emissions. Our highest one is actually from traffic, and it's from pollution. And it usually is high in the CRD, but it's especially high in our municipality. And I do think that that is from people commuting,
yeah,
right? That's from people getting to the 9-to-5 job and then coming back home. Right? People will live in different areas. They'll live out in the Western communities and they'll commute in because, I mean, if you look at hubs of job growth on the peninsula, you'll see the biggest one is actually the Keating Industrial Park. And I think it will be getting bigger and it can get bigger with good policy. And as those businesses grow and as our businesses in Saanichton, Brentwood and Sydney and all of those areas and those sectors grow, we need to find ways to bring people out there so that they can work and live and play in the same areas.
Well, now you are expanding beyond your age. So back to our earlier discussion around diversity on council, likely the issues are fundamentally the same. People want to live, work, and play in this region. Mm-hmm. And you're starting to address those key issues of lack of affordable workforce housing, a lack of transportation options, lack of jobs, lack of well-paying jobs. Therefore, why don't we touch upon now this issue of a lack of affordable housing? In North Saanich, there's literally a war going on over this issue. And it's difficult to have an objective, pragmatic opinion and move that issue forward. What is that like in Central Saanich? What can you lend to that issue come November to helping solve this problem?
No, it's definitely a concern. We talk about North Saanich a lot as kind of one of those examples of a very fragmented council. I think what it looks like to me, firstly, if we talk about just that issue on council, is that we are moving into 4-year terms this year, right? This election in November will be the first time when we have 4-year terms of people sitting on council, which means I think that personality is going to become a crucial factor when you're going to the polls. Because what it means is that the informed voter needs to look at who's sitting on council and go, are these guys going to be able to play nice? It's not about agreeing with each other at all times. It's not about groupthink. What it is about is people who are able to actually disagree and disagree in a constructive way that actually does come out with a byproduct. We don't need mediators like North Saanich has had or anything like that. I think, Central Saanich is doing a good job of that currently in the fact that they are able to actually get through a meeting and everyone's friends at the end of it. And it's all very, very positive in that regard. With regards to affordable housing, though, and workforce housing, I don't, affordable housing is a little bit tough because I think then suddenly there's the connotation that people bring in with regards to, you know, spending taxpayers' money to housing the homeless, which is a noble cause in itself. When I think of housing for workforce, I think about attainable housing, housing that's in the market that people are interested in, and also housing that actually resonates with the buyer as something positive that they're interested in. So as within young families nowadays, I don't think that the goal is currently the 3,000 square foot home on a half acre lot as it used to be. Now, the problem from a policy perspective is that's what our official community plan assumes that everybody wants. It was a plan made at a different time, and it was assuming that everybody wanted what the boomers wanted, right? Keeping up with the Joneses, everyone needs three cars, a boat, and you need this massive house. Although that's still desirable for some, and there should be areas of the neighborhood that are left that way if the neighborhoods decide that they want to keep it that way, I think that a proactive policy would be looking at the official community plan and finding areas where it's like, you know what, we can afford to put a little bit of a, you know, little bit more infill, little bit more density, some smaller homes. And you know what? Personally, I don't need a half acre lot. I don't have time to be spending on the backyard every weekend, right? People are going away for trips. They're going away, hockey tournaments now take what, like 3 days for people's kids. It's ridiculous. So, I mean, a lot of the time that could have been spent maybe tending to the yard or, you know, maybe one of the parents didn't work previously. We now see that both parents are working. And they're feeling the pinch. So you need housing and policy that's able to accommodate to that in the appropriate areas.
All right. So I'm going to ask you the big question now, because we've been sort of skirting around the edge of this. You know, when we talk about affordability and there's interesting, there was an article, I'm going to send it to you, John, that was posted yesterday about Vancouver and the unique problems that Vancouver has around affordable housing, which is largely that there's foreigners who buy up houses at any price, right? We don't have that in Victoria. But what we do have is a very beautiful place where people really want to live here. And we don't have the jobs that match the prices. And so when you think of Victoria as one of the most expensive places, and I'm talking Greater Victoria, as one of the most expensive places to live in the world, but certainly in Canada as well, there's a disconnect between the cost of living here and what one could reasonably expect to earn living here as well. And I find it very difficult to be optimistic about the future of a region, certainly when, you know, a region that isn't just a bunch of retired people, because that's inevitably where that sort of thing would lead to. And so having the opportunity to sit down in front of a young person who's recently graduated from university and prior to that high school, maybe you could tell me, you know, is there any optimism within your generation for, you know, being able to grow up and live in Victoria and continue to live in Victoria? Or do people just leave like they did when I was, you know, graduated from high school many years ago?
Four years ago.
So it's a great question. I think that when we talk about the issue, people still consider leaving and people still talk about it and they will leave. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, now we're getting on to the issue of why I'm running for council though, yeah. Right? I think I need to be realistic in addressing what a councillor actually can address and that I'm not going to solve the housing issues for an entire region. Yeah. And I'm not going to necessarily create jobs because I think that I'll leave that up to business. But at the end of the day, as a councillor, what I do want to positively affect is policy that can be put in place to look at the needs of a community. And so, I mean, you mentioned retirees. I'm actually quite happy to have retirees living and in our municipality. I think that they're essential to a full community. And I think we need policies that can address that, such as walkability and making sure that it's a commuter friendly place with areas with crosswalks and things that work for people. But when it comes to being able to live and work in the same area, I completely agree. Council can be doing more, right? There's areas within the town boundaries in Saanichton, Keating, and Central Saanich, maybe not Keating because it's industrial, but definitely Brentwood Bay and Saanichton, where we can be finding more housing, right? We can find areas to build up and densify. And we've been looking at that currently with myself and others and with council on the Planning Advisory Commission. that we have where we've actually been able to look at those places and say, hey, you know what? Because we don't want to affect the ALR, right? We've got 66% of our municipality roughly is ALR. That's 2/3. It's a ridiculous amount. We don't want to sprawl. So how are we going to address this? We have to look at pockets of residential where we may be able to infill, or areas within our towns where maybe a developer would want to put some stories on there, and maybe mixed use, right? Create housing for people on the top floors, and then some office space in the middle, and some retail on the bottom, right? I think that that's the future of our towns. And I think we can do it effectively if we have smart growth that is able to look to the future for the next, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, right? Make it realistic.
And, since you're nearing, retirement age, John, just for the record, I don't want people to think that I was bashing retirees because my grandmother's one as well.
No, you're not bashing retirees. In fact, I'm honored to be, in and amongst a couple of, young folk who want to make a difference in our community. I think that a lot of people of retirement age fought long and hard to allow people to have an opinion and to make a difference in their community. And there's a certain sadness that youth in general, although very active in their thinking, aren't as involved as I suspect we would hope they would be. So I think it's great, Niall, that you're running. I'm going to work very hard to get Paul to run in some capacity or have an influence in our community, because we need young voices of a new generation to be involved. Well done. How do people get a hold of you? Tell us your website address, perhaps your Twitter handle, etc.
I try to keep it simple. It's nialpaltiel.ca. So you'll see that on the link here, nialpaltiel.ca, the website. It's nialpaltiel@gmail.com, all one word, is my email address, all lowercase. And then same with Facebook, Niall Paltiel, Twitter @NiallPaltiel. I keep it all same. I could keep it simple for everyone. Yep.
So if you can master the spelling of that, you will find this gentleman.
And I'll put it in our notes.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being with us here today. And, it's a real pleasure. And, up next segment is, This Week in Politics.
Welcome to the John, Paul, and Mike Show. And we have our fun segment, This Week in Politics. Woo-hoo. And there sure were a few issues. And in fact, we have a guest on with us today,
yeah.
Niall Paltiel.
Remaining with us today.
Remaining, that's right. Yeah. And that is a bonus for us.
That is dangerous territory. Dangerous, Niall. So we've got a list of interesting topics this week. I guess we may as well start with the 800-pound gorilla in the room, which is the teacher strike. You know what? I actually don't really care about the teacher strike anymore. So you go ahead, John.
It's likely you're fatigued with the teacher strike as much as care. Because I think everyone's very passionate about it. I'm sensing, personally, a certain sadness about it all. I think the BCTF has made some strategic blunders and has given the government a lot of control of their destiny, so to speak, which is almost opposite to what I think they wanted to have. And I now sense teachers walking the picket line, and they have no exit strategy. And in any business, organizational, community endeavor, I think one tries to think of a way to end whatever project one's involved with. And they're stuck, and their one mediator based solution, Vince Reddy, decided that he's too busy, which I think's a load of BS.
He's doing his hair. I posted on Facebook that he's busy washing his hair this week, so he can't help out.
Yeah. Well, I'm sad because I think the teachers are at a serious disadvantage now, and that's somehow not fair. I would like and wish that this thing has some resolution, and that teachers are not stuck, so to speak, due to their own unions misfortunes. So I'm feeling a tad sad this week, which is an emotive response as opposed to an objective one, which from some folks' perspectives might be, well, they deserve what they're getting.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that necessarily. What I would say is what I've been saying all along, which is teachers are poorly represented by the BCTF, and if they would all recognize that collectively, they can't do it individually. I know many do individually recognize it, but if they're willing to kind of speak up and get their peers, they could actually get together and fire that union, which has done them no good for 25 years, and hire proper representation. And, you know, there's this, there's a big push, and I noticed this on social media, we are the BCTF. And it's, you know, like the BCTF is scrambling for relevance amongst teachers. So they've, you know, convinced a number of teachers that the two are inseparable. And I'm sorry, I'm not convinced.
Well, it appears, at least this week in politics, that there's some attempt to get the two sides to talk to each other. And I hope that happens. And I hope they come to a solution very quickly for the sake of everyone, certainly for the sake of teachers who are not receiving strike pay and are not getting paid, which fundamentally, no matter what side you're on, is just bad.
And a point raised I heard today from the Board of BC Trustees, which I thought was really interesting, and I'm actually completely in favor of, is they said they would actually like to see the teachers and the teachers and the government remove the lockout and the walkout for the last, what is it now, 5 days of class or 4 days of class, so that teachers and students can spend the last few days together, especially those who are graduating and going to be leaving the secondary school system. And then that way, at least it would show good faith in their negotiation and that they do believe that there is a solution coming soon. And then they can go back to their negotiations, whether it's in the summer or September.
So I'm going to give that a 3% chance.
You're being very optimistic.
Yeah. Oh, it's important. It's important, John, to remain optimistic at all times. It is what it is. And, I think when we first started talking about this, you were kind of doom and gloom and, how is this ever going to possibly be rectified? I sort of hoped that there was, some third way, and I don't see it happening.
Paul, we have to ensure that your voice will always win over mine. Doom and gloom is no way to want to end or be seen as being the sense of any kind of dispute. So I certainly hope that there is a way out of this. Nonetheless, let's see what happens next week, and we'll chat about it then. There was a significant development around a federal decision with regard to the Northern Gateway Pipeline.
Oh.
Is that something of interest to John, Paul, and Mike?
Sure. Well, it's a big impact, obviously, on Canada and in terms of our export policy when it comes to the oil that's being processed in Alberta. I understood that there was something like 130 conditions attached to the approval as well. So it's not a sure thing as far as I see, but it's kind of heading that way. And we haven't seen the protests and the lawsuits yet.
I understand you've had more federal political experience than I do. I'm sensing that the feds approve this, but really don't expect it ever to happen. And therefore, one has to think, did Harper and his government approve this because he's from Alberta? But they really know this will never happen. There seems to be an endless amount of significant stakeholders lining up saying they will die before this pipeline gets built.
Well, and optically, I think that it was a no-brainer for the Harper government. And the reason for that, no matter what side you're on, you can see that. And that's because essentially right now, he's pushing for that pipeline that's also going down into the states, right? That's going in and he's waiting for Washington's approval from that going into the states. So how can you rightfully say, well, we don't want one going off of BC's coast, but we want to send one down to the states. And they're obviously worried about the environmental impact there. Mm-hmm. So I think optically and politically, he really had no choice but to go through in supporting it.
Well, and he's cornering Obama, right? Obama now has to decide, if they want to partake in this economic boom or not. And, you know, there's a lot of issues around this coast. I mean, people have to recognize we have tankers going down the coast already. They're getting oil out of Alberta like there's no tomorrow as well, right? So, but you know, the volume would definitely increase. And, you know, there'd need to be some rules. There'd need to be some regulations. There'd need to be, cleanup response teams on the ready 24/7 to deal with, potential spills, et cetera. And it's a big project.
All right. So we'll likely decide that this might have been more politically motivated than practically motivated. And we'll revisit that in future shows. There is a big regional sewage issue for Lower Vancouver Island, which also seems to be stuck, similar to these other issues. And last week, the Capital Regional District, a consortium of our local municipal politicians, came up with some ways to move this forward. Once again, it seemed on council that was going to go nowhere. I'm particularly interested, considering we have a guest today who plans to become involved in municipal politics, less on the sewage issue, more on this idea of a capital regional district bureaucracy, whether that works. Is it something, are there other ways? Paul has talked in previous shows around amalgamation. Let's just throw this over to Niall for a few seconds and see if we can get him to say the wrong thing.
I don't think that'll be hard on the issue of amalgamation in the CRD. The CRD absolutely needs to be accountable. And you have a lot of people in the community who are not politically involved who would not necessarily know what it is the CRD does or how the people who run the CRD come into that position. In Central Saanich, we're fortunate enough that our mayor, Alistair Bryson, is actually the chair of the CRD. Mm-hmm. And so he's been extremely open and he's been, he's great to talk to if you do have an issue about the Capital Regional District. However, that's for myself personally and for the people in Central Saanich. I don't know if it's that easy for everyone else. When we talk about coordination within the CRD and intermunicipal coordination, I do think more of it needs to happen. You can see that we do fall behind in those regards, and we do see where that needs to be addressed. For instance, the peninsula between Central Saanich, North Saanich, and Sydney, they have had an emergency strategy for, I think, over 10 years now. Between what would happen. I mean, I think it's called PEMO, right? The Peninsula Emergency Measures Organization, right? And they deal with what would happen in an emergency. Where would our ambulance go? How would our resources be distributed? It's only now, or since actually the Christchurch incident in New Zealand, the earthquake there, that Saanich and Victoria have actually looked at coordinating forces. So it actually took a massive global incident to occur for Saanich and Victoria to realize, oh guys, we actually should get our act together and start working together here. So I think that coordination is important. I don't, because the data isn't there yet on whether or not amalgamation will be good or bad within Victoria, I think it's impossible to say. As an elected person in Central Saanich, I need to do the best for the residents and ratepayers in Central Saanich, which means until that data is there, it's impossible to say whether or not amalgamation is the answer, but coordination certainly is. Mm. And even within the CRD, I think we can see a better job of that.
For someone so young, you're remarkably articulate. I'm extremely proud that we have folks like yourself thinking about getting involved with the community. So those were three issues. Maybe next week in politics, we can talk about them and see where they're at. For those of you that aren't familiar, the Paul, and John, Paul, and Mike, is actually a global social media expert, has been a co-founder of conferences specifically involved with the development of social media in our society. And you've recently had interesting experiences around the psychology of people who are posting on Facebook and on Twitter. And interestingly, from you commenting on really how disappointed you are with how this, how some of this commentary is occurring. Why don't you give us some sense of your specific issues and what's going on, Paul, that's upsetting you on this?
Well, you know, I guess the issue with social media is that, you're hiding behind a keyboard, whether it's your phone or your computer, right? And, but you're still identified. And so I just find it kind of surprising when you see some of the comments from some of the people you think you know fairly well who turn out to have the sometimes fairly outrageous opinions on things. I know for myself, one of the things that drives me and in terms of the things that I'm passionate about in life is I'm very passionate about injustice. When I see something that's just wrong happening, I get very upset about it. And I don't know what that is. Maybe it's some mental defect. but ultimately, I've been like that my whole life. I was the guy that defended, the school kid from the bully, right? I was on national television when I was 20 years old, defending gay rights. You know, it was, you know, like I've been out there defending, the rights of people, things like free speech. You know, if somebody wants to have an outrageous opinion, they should be allowed to have that outrageous opinion. They should be allowed to, communicate that. And if other people want to shut them down, which they can do by making a counter argument, absolutely. But shutting people down systematically using public, government funds, that's called tyranny. And we've seen this around the world many times, and it's very frightening. And I fear that as a society, people are becoming more inclined to accept tyranny for the things that they find to be not suited to their opinion. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think as a society we should be accepting that. Mm-hmm. So.
No, I completely agree with you. I mean, a conversation has to happen. I think it's, once again, I think, John, you brought this up earlier. It's one of the principles that, you know, our grandparents have fought for, right? And it's something that we need to keep alive and keep valuable today. And I think, you know, it was funny. The other day I actually got in trouble from somebody because I used the word NIMBY, right? The not in my backyard. And I got in trouble for saying that. And they said, well, what about the NIMBYs in your community? And I'm like, you know what? Everyone at a point becomes a NIMBY,
yeah,
right? If there's a skyscraper going up next to my house, you know what? I'm a NIMBY because I don't want that, I want that privacy and I don't want that to happen. However, when I use that term, in the same way people look at the term developer as being negative, I think that when you go into a community, there's 10% on either side that are just not willing to listen to people's issues, mm-hmm, right? They stick to their side and they polarize a debate, and it's not about a conversation. And I don't know what to do with that 10%, because as somebody who's interested in counsel and interested and listens to the community, I'm more focused on that 80% in the middle that's willing to have a conversation.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And, you know, and that really speaks to what we've tried to do here on this podcast is to try to get sensible conversations happening where all opinions are welcome. Right. Anyway, so the issue for me this week, and it's not actually really this week. This happened way back in May. Nanaimo Council decided arbitrarily last minute to cancel a contract for the Vancouver Island Conference Center for a group that had a leadership conference. This leadership conference that apparently some of the speakers were Malcolm Gladwell, Desmond Tutu, I think Jack Welch. So a number of very well-known speakers. One of the sponsors of the conference was a company out of the United States called Chick-fil-A, which is a fast food franchise.
Sort of equivalent to KFC or something, potentially?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. I've never been. I don't know it, except sort of hearing, you know, because it's an American franchise. I think, as I understand, there's one outlet in Canada somewhere. But anyway, so this company... apparently one of the executives, I don't know if it's the CEO or who it was, but a few years ago had made some disparaging remarks about homosexuals or the LGBT community, uses their own money, I guess, to fund, groups that do kind of crazy stuff like trying to fix homosexuals and, you know, encourage them to change to become heterosexuals, things like that, which I think is kind of nonsense based on my experience. Maybe there's someone out there that worked for them, but anyway, but regardless, Nanaimo Council was so offended by the connection that this sponsor had an executive that had these things happen 3 years ago or whenever it was, that they felt compelled to cancel the event with virtually no notice, that was to be held in the public facility of the conference center. And then they went on. That wasn't enough. They went on to make some extremely offensive remarks, about Christians. And one of the counselors in particular, his name escapes me, made comparisons, between Christian beliefs and criminal behavior and abducting the girls being abducted in Africa. Like, this was all kind of correlated, even though probably most of the girls in Africa were Christians that were abducted. Anyway, and then one of the other counselors decided that because there was a speaker that may or may not have held some opinions that they found to not be in line with the Nanaimo Council's opinion, that they should censor, black out that speaker at this third-party conference that's renting their facility. And I'm watching this coverage on the Nanaimo website, and I'm thinking to myself, like, what world do we live in where councils can, you know, have this sense, you know, they want to censor it, they want to shut it down? You know, like, this is, we live in a pluralistic society, we should be tolerant of other people's opinions.
You know, and we've seen this for years, this fine line between allowing free speech and then shutting down hate or meme-related discussion. And it will likely go on for some time. You talked about this on social media. What happened?
Well, what happened was a number of people chimed in agreement, and a number of people chimed in to say, well, of course, the news agency that broke it, unfortunately, was Sun News, and there's a lot of people who have strong opinions about Sun News Network, and so they chimed in basically saying, you know, this is just sensational nonsense by Sun News. And then there was some shocking comments from people I would consider to be my friends who basically say, yeah, you know, like, Christians should all be banned from public facilities. You know, taxpayer dollars go to pay that. Yeah. and that, you know, what was the other one? I'm thinking to myself, John, I'm thinking, yeah, and why stop there? Like, let's do public executions and book burnings, right? You know,
where does this lead, right? This is not a good path.
There's a lot of folks who don't get involved with social media commentary because they're scared of what appears to be that 10% fringe element that seem to be a majority of people who talk about sensational issues on social media.
Yeah, it's definitely a bizarre phenomenon, and it's something that, you know, I find really bothersome in the sense that we live in a free and pluralistic society. We should be, you know, promoting free speech, not trying to shut it down at every corner.
Well, I noticed some of your posts on the teacher strike. There were really some objective, sensible points of view you were trying to have a dialogue about that deteriorated into a bad dialogue. And I don't know. It's interesting that we think social media really is the ultimate democratic vehicle for communication and expression, when in fact, when one gets engaged in it, it could be somewhat and sometimes the exact opposite.
Yeah. Name calling and mudslinging, and whoever has the most mud, to sling, the fastest, will just shut people out. And there was a number of people in this particular thread who just basically, checked out, including myself. By the end of it, I just said, you know what? I feel sick about some of these comments. I'm just going to check out because, you know, like clearly we're not going to see eye to eye. And the, you know, I understand that people, cause I agree with them. I understand that people took issue with this guy's, methods of wanting to quote help homosexuals become heterosexuals. Mm-hmm. And you know, like, for all, I don't know him from Adam, right? Maybe that he thought he was doing this good thing and it came from a good place, right? But regardless, we can all agree that that's probably a ridiculous notion. But does that mean that as a society, that he's not allowed to say it. He's not allowed to, and he wasn't even saying it at this conference, right? What he was saying at this conference was nothing because the company was just a sponsor,
right,
of this conference.
Well, I think you can see an example of this too in just the fact that it's so easy just to say no, right? It's so easy just to shut down a conversation and not see eye to eye with the other person. I think a great example of that in BC was in the last provincial election, right? You had between the BC Liberals and the BC NDP, the BC NDP just said no to the Kinder Morgan pipeline. Mm-hmm. Whereas the BC Liberals didn't even have to say yes. They just said, hey, we'll talk about it, right? Like, we'll look at it down the road. And it turned out, I think, that that was a very decisive issue. And it turned out that at the end of the day, most British Columbians actually voted in favor of a party that was willing to actually, as their quote was, work to get to yes, right? It's not about getting to yes today, but if it does happen, it's about the dialogue on the way there, as opposed to just saying no. Because I think, as you've seen with the comments from your friends, Paul, it's so easy just to say no or just to shut out an entire side of an argument. Mm-hmm. But I, for every side of the argument, there is a grain of truth. There is some merit. And until you can lay all your cards out on the table in a productive and constructive way, how are you going to work to get to yes? And, you know, whatever is going to happen if we're always just agreeing to disagree, right? That nothing will happen.
I agree. And, you know, part of the issue I take with this is I've been on the front lines of this culture war. You know, we've seen so much positive movement within the society to recognize everybody, right? You know, it's Pride Week, right? we have made enormous strides in the society, not by putting one group over the other or by through triumphalism. What we've done as a culture and as a society is we've recognized everybody's part of this society, right? So the question to people like some of the people on my Facebook is, you know, do you want to build a society that's intolerant now towards those people who were previously intolerant towards you? Because that's a kind of also a recipe for disaster, right? And, you know, having these sort of, very extreme opinions about, you know, Christians, banning Christians from things and stuff like that, like, that's only going to take the hardliners that still haven't kind of come to recognize that, you know, their line of thinking is off. It's only going to solidify their position. They're only going to double down, right? And so, what's the objective there, right?
Very frustrating.
Well, I think on that note, we've covered off four topics. We've touched the tip of the free speech debate, which I would hope we'll get an update from next week. It's of crucial importance. We had a guest today, a young man who is starting to say, I want to be part of our community. I want to be involved. That's admirable and honorable, and I wish you good luck. So until next week, adios.
Take care.